WNYC in New York. This is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield. In Charlotte, North Carolina this week, protest, disorder, and violence in the wake of the latest fatal police shooting of a black man in a parked car.
The victim was 43-year-old Keith Lamont Scott.
Police say that it all started when officers went to arrest another man and encountered Scott instead.
Police say this man posed an immediate risk to the officer who shot and killed him, but the man's family says he didn't even have a gun. It was a book.
At various points, the anger boiled over into mob destruction, and one protester died at the hand of an unknown assailant, all because yet one more African-American, Keith Scott, was shot dead without provocation. Or maybe because he was threatening police officers with a gun and refused to drop it. The cops say the latter, Scott's family the former.
The police just shot my daddy four times for being black. They gonna tell us my daddy had a gun, so that's why they shoot him. But they didn't do nothing. They just pulled up undercover.
Scott's daughter at the scene shortly after the shooting. The family said Scott was brandishing not a weapon, but a book. Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Chief Kerr Putney.
We did not find a book that has been made reference to. And we did find a weapon, and the weapon was there, and the witnesses corroborated it too, beyond just the officers.
Nonetheless, he says video of the incident from police body cams is inconclusive. He showed that video to Scott's family, presumably to put an end to the quietly reading in his car while executed narrative. But Chief Putney won't make the video public, out of respect for Keith Scott. Transparency, he said, doesn't mean the public right to know everything.
If you think we should display a victim's worst day for public consumption, that is not the transparency I'm speaking of, sir.
Or maybe he thinks the video's inconclusiveness will let black citizens fill in the blanks with their own hard-earned reality. Radio host Richard Fowler on Fox News.
Once again, we have seen 400 years of compounded bigotry and racism play itself out in policies in police departments across this country. You have to be blind not to see it.
This is the larger truth explanation for civil disorder, that the particulars of Scott's killing are less relevant than the daily African-American experience of being under suspicion and the recurring nightmare of police violence in Ferguson, Baltimore, Staten Island, Cleveland, Milwaukee, North Charleston, Tulsa. Hence, a last straw spasm of frustration and rage. On Friday, a cell phone video of the Charlotte shooting incident emerged, recorded by Keith Scott's wife, even as she pleaded with her husband and the police to be careful.
Don't shoot him. Don't shoot him. He has no weapon. He doesn't have a gun. He has a TBI. He's not going to do anything to you guys. He just took his medicine.
Harrowing, but taken at too great a distance to be especially clarifying. Meantime, there were some actual, if inconvenient, facts to process. For one, the officer who fired was black. For another, North Carolina is an open carry state. Having a gun or even holding one is not in itself illegal, much less grounds for summary execution. President of the Charlotte branch of the NAACP, Corin Mack.
In my mind and in most of the community's mind, it really doesn't matter if he had a gun. At the end of the day, we have the right under the Second Amendment to carry here in North Carolina. And so I don't want anyone to walk away from this conversation today thinking that a video showing he had a gun in any way says that he was guilty of anything.
In the murk of the events themselves, such context stood out. Other voices merely played their partisan roles and filled the factual vacuum with polemic. And cable news, which is in the conflict business, was only too pleased to provide the forum. This was former New York Police Commissioner Bernard Kerik on Fox, characterizing the protests as cheap opportunism by the likes of Black Lives Matter.
They're not from there. They come from outside. The instigators, they come from outside. We've seen this over and over. Right, an excuse to do this.
And if they were locals, then really, Obama's big government is to blame because the few remaining programs designed to relieve poverty breed not only dependency, but children of color destined for depravity. GOP consultant Ed Rollins.
And a lot of the federal policies discourage families and basically put mothers into situations that they had multiple children and couldn't basically control the elements. And obviously now see them rising up with no hope, no employment, no potential, and their dreams have been crashed. And they think the only way is to get a gun, go rob something, go sell dope, or go smash and burn something.
Conservative outlets as a group were deaf to the only two salient questions: whether Keith Scott would be dead today if he weren't black, and why so many African Americans believe the answer to that question is no. One Fox reporter on the street in Charlotte was schooled by a protester whose very presence at such a chaotic scene, reporter Steve Harrigan, was at a loss to understand.
If a man was shot about 50 yards over there, we don't know by who, why are you here?
Because I serve a purpose, sir. I serve a purpose. My father serves a purpose. My brother serves a purpose.
Are you?
I'm here because guess what? I could be at work, at school, in my car. I could still get shot by the police. I could get shot anywhere. Do you see this?
I do.
Do you see me?
Yes.
Do you see you? We are not the same. We are human. But I am black and you are white. So don't tell me.
If we learned anything over the last few days, it was certainly that. The elusive details of Charlotte are the ultimate gray area, and yet they're also simply a matter of black and white. Coming up, recruiting terrorists from beyond the grave. This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Just before 8 in the morning last Monday, millions of New York City cell phones started sounding the alarm, literally. A wireless emergency alert, more commonly used for weather warnings and amber alerts, was deployed for the first time in the service of a manhunt following last Saturday's explosions in New York's Chelsea neighborhood and the discovery of 5 more devices in Elizabeth, New Jersey. The call for vigilance was short and sweet. Okay, maybe not sweet.
Wanted, Ahmad Khan Rahami, 28-year-old male. See media for picture. Call 911 if seen.
Not a whole lot of information there. Who was Rahami? What was he wanted for? What did he look like? Google it, the message seemed to say. That's because it basically couldn't say anything else. The FCC has rules, perhaps obsolete ones, governing such phone alerts. The agency is eager to exploit up-to-date technology to deliver more and more pertinent information, but it's running into resistance. Mark Harris wrote about the wireless emergency alert system for the website Motherboard last month. Mark, welcome to On the Media.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks.
What was your reaction when you saw that the system had been employed this way?
My first reaction was actually great. You know, we've seen it being used successfully for Amber Alerts for years. Now, when I drilled down and actually saw the message, it did send a little shiver down my spine. The vagueness of that message seemed to be a license for people receiving it to perhaps target people of the age and the ethnicity that the name suggested.
Wireless alerts like this were introduced way back in 2012 which may as well be the Jurassic period. What's happened to the technology since?
Absolutely nothing. And in fact, that technology that was introduced in 2012 was actually based on technology back from the 1990s. And the idea back in 2012 was, well, you know what, there are still plenty of 2G phones around. Obviously, things have moved on since then, and now modern phones do have the capability to actually accept longer messages.
And there's a move afoot to expand the size of these alerts. Their 90-character limit is about, what, two-thirds of a tweet. How much bigger and more detailed can they get?
The agencies that issue these alerts, the Amber Alerts, the Weather Service, and now these Manhunt Alerts, they've kind of settled on 360 characters as a good length of a message. And particularly, they also want to include things like photos, maps. They want users to be able to click on a phone number or click on a website to get more information or to report a sighting. And they also want much better geo-targeting, much better localization of these alerts so that they only go to the people who really need them.
We get that based on the configuration of our surrounding towers. And the state of the art isn't that artful, right? It's difficult to reach exactly the right audience for even an approaching nor'easter.
Right now, an alerting agency will highlight an area on a map that they think is going to be affected by an event. Now, that has to be translated by the wireless carriers into particular cell towers, because the message goes out at the moment to every single phone currently attached to that cell tower. They choose a larger footprint, so they make sure they get everybody they want to hit. And so you end up with people who will receive that message who's just not appropriate. Perhaps they live away from a river that's about to be flooded. Now, the idea is that if you leverage these technologies that we have on our phones, the GPS systems and the other location services that can locate your phone to within a few meters, then that's actually a much smarter way to do it. And then it ensures that when the message arrives on your phone then decides, actually, I'm not quite in the area that this message is specified for, so I won't display it. It could even be even smarter, and it could say, well, actually, your phone isn't in the area right now, but the area of the alert is perhaps where your child's school is. And so it's a much more intelligent way to manage the alerts. And it means that there'll be fewer false alarms and then fewer people who are opting out of potentially valuable alerts in the future.
But the people who would have to deploy this technology, the telecoms, Verizon and so forth, and the hardware manufacturers of the phones are not necessarily wild about the prospects.
Yeah, they've got a lot of objections. They kind of vary from quite valid concerns about, well, you know what, if we put a clickable web link in an emergency message, what if everyone clicks on it at the same time? And that creates the kind of network congestion you see at big sporting events. Whereas if you included a special link in the message that's linked through to a page that just had one image, you're actually talking about much less data flowing across the network and actually a much more controllable experience. They're also worried about just really actually having to do the work.
There was a lot of criticism about the Rahami alert on slippery slope grounds. You know, was it really necessary? Was anything gained? And how can we trust the government, which has a very nasty habit of overusing the tools that it has at its disposal, whether it's police powers or intelligence gathering or actual physical equipment? Can we trust the government to be scrupulous in its application? In fact, some people mentioned the Ray Bradbury book and the movie Fahrenheit 451.
Calling all citizens wanted for murder, Montag, occupation, the fireman. The criminal is alone and on foot. Let each one stand at his front door, look and listen.
Is that a reasonable concern?
I think it's always a reasonable concern when the government can reach into your pocket. But I think there are reasons to be not quite so fearful of it. For a start, obviously, you can turn these off. You can turn off the Amber Alerts. You can turn off the imminent threat alerts, which include the weather and things like this Manhunt. You can't turn off the presidential alert, but they've never been issued anyway. And then secondly, we haven't seen any history of agencies overusing these in the past. The agencies that I've seen comments from have really been quite overcautious about when to deploy these alerts, precisely to avoid alert fatigue. And in fact, it's more of just an updating. We used to watch the television with breaking news alerts, but we don't do that anymore.
I guess one of the most prominent emergency alert foul-ups recently was in the wake of the Texas shootings, in which the Dallas police issued a tweet with an image of a guy who they said was a person of interest because he was seen in the crowd carrying a semi-automatic long gun. It turns out that, you know, it's an open carry state, and the guy was sadly within his rights to be standing there watching with an AR-15 on his shoulder, but it was mistaken identity and, among other things, a complete wild goose chase.
I think one of the strengths of the wireless emergency alert system is that it's not just a question of going to your computer and pressing send on a tweet. There is this structure in place where any alerts have to go through a system that's designed by FCC and FEMA, and various people have to sign off on a message before it actually gets sent out. Inevitably, there will be mistakes, of course, and you can always issue another alert. But we haven't really seen a sort of big mistake with wireless emergency alerts yet. Obviously, I think the messages could be more useful. This most recent alert kind of shows the strength and the weakness of the system. To be able to issue an alert, for example, stay away from a window on a certain block in New York because, you know, there might be an explosion, seems a fantastic idea. But being able to just put a name and an age of a person is really less useful. And so you can see how adding a photo to that could definitely add utility. So I think this is a great step for bringing it to people's attention. And I think it only highlights the decision that the FCC, you know, hopefully will take next week when it meets to bring these wireless emergency alerts truly into the 21st century.
Mark, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. It's been a real pleasure.
Mark Harris is a freelance technology reporter. He wrote about the wireless emergency alert system for the website Motherboard. In recent years, major terrorist attacks, the Boston bombing, the shootings in San Bernardino and Orlando, the methods of killing varied, but the perpetrators shared one common element, a fascination with the American-born jihadist cleric Anwar el-Awlaki. Most recently, Awlaki's name was found in a notebook owned by the alleged Chelsea bomber, cited as an inspiration.
We're getting new details about a notebook found on Rahami when he was captured, a notebook that includes writings about Anwar el-Awlaki, the Islamic extremist, the terror recruiter.
Anwar al-Awlaki was killed by a U.S. drone strike 5 years ago, almost to the day, September 30th, 2011. But his work as an al-Qaeda propagandist and recruiter lives on. Scott Shane is a reporter for the New York Times and the author of Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone, a book about how Awlaki came to be eliminated, or as the military like to say, quote, removed from the battlefield.
His greater importance is on the battlefield of the internet, and killing him really enhanced his status, since many of his admirers see him as a martyr, so that he speaks today with the greater authority of martyrdom from beyond the grave.
Tell me about the power of Awlaki the martyr. What has it meant?
Well, this is a guy who, unlike I think every other major jihadist, propagandist, or ideologue, had a long career as a mainstream imam, as a mainstream preacher, for years before he followed the path to al-Qaeda.
We're talking about ways to bring an end to this war. And we, as Muslims, we want to bring an end to terrorism more than anybody else.
He left the U.S., he moved to the U.K., then he moved to Yemen. And at each step, he becomes more radical, more militant, more accepting of violence.
We are against evil. And America as a whole has turned into a nation of evil.
Because that long runway in which he had established his credentials as a mainstream preacher of Islam, he can kind of carry somebody from knowing nothing about the religion all the way to the idea that we're at war and it's your obligation to go shoot something up or set off a bomb.
He was kind of a fair-haired boy in the media in the aftermath of 9/11, even with the government. He was kind of a designated Muslim, dependable for speaking calmly and in moderation against violence, but also against flawed American policy.
You know, this is a guy who in early 2001 had landed as the imam at one of the big D.C. area mosques. And as it turned out, he was sort of the right guy in the right place at the right time, because along comes 9/11 and suddenly Americans are very interested in Islam, very interested in al-Qaeda, wondering what the hell just happened. And here is this young, very well-spoken imam who speaks American English without an accent and has a knack for explaining things. So this guy was discovered, and he was in the New York Times, my paper, he was in the Washington Post. He was on NPR. He was on PBS. The Washington Post actually followed him around for a day and made a video called Understanding Ramadan.
Muslims abstain from three things during the month of Ramadan: food, drink, and any sexual activity. And that is from sunrise to sunset.
And at that time, he always condemned 9/11. Indeed, he said in the mosque that the special role of American Muslims was to be a bridge between the United States and a billion Muslims worldwide. His views on that later changed.
The other thing that happened at approximately the same moment in history was the internet. He was an imam with not only his own decent-sized mosque in Falls Church, Virginia, but the virtual mosque of the World Wide Web.
Exactly. This is a guy who was an early adopter of technology. In the 90s, he had his kid brother on the sidewalk after Friday prayers selling his sermons on cassette. Then he began publishing these boxed sets of CDs. Eventually, he had his own website, anwaralawlaki.com. He had a very active Facebook page. And finally, at the end of his life, his home became YouTube.
You mentioned the FBI investigation because of his accidental or not accidental connection to a couple of the 9/11 hijackers. And that's actually where his troubles began. Can you tell me what grew from that?
This guy was on a trajectory to become sort of a national spokesman for American Muslims. So what derailed this? He had left the U.S. in a big hurry at the end of March in 2002, just about 6 months after 9/11. And the assumption had been that he had gotten sick of hostility to Islam after 9/11 and had just gotten fed up and left. When I reported this out for the book, I found out that was not the case.
Turns out that the FBI had pulled a kind of Martin Luther King on him and had surveilled him during many, many visits to prostitutes, and they had the goods.
Yeah, I mean, the FBI was not particularly interested in this guy's sex life. They were following him because they were worried that he might have ties to Al-Qaeda. They satisfied themselves that he didn't have any ties to Al-Qaeda. This guy was not a terrorist. But in the process, they documented these regular weekly or biweekly visits to prostitutes in Washington hotels.
And you posed a really interesting question in your piece, which is, what if the FBI had sort of done the full MLK on this guy and actually discredited him on a moral basis with the revelations of his use of sex workers, instead of actually having to kill him later and to create a martyr doing it? Do you know if anyone in the government ever considered the discrediting route?
So there was some discussion about charging him for sort of an obscure law called the Travel Act. He was crossing the line from Virginia into D.C. to visit these prostitutes, and they could kind of come up with a case. It wasn't pursued. And in fact, these massive files documenting his prostitution habit are only public because folks filed for them under the Freedom of Information Act. The FBI was not giving them up willingly, letting alone publicizing them. But some Muslim commentators have said it might have been more effective with the often sort of puritanical young Muslim men who are particularly drawn to this guy to point out to them that he was an outrageous hypocrite. He was preaching on the sanctity of marriage. He was married with three kids at the time while he was pursuing these prostitutes. And it was clearly his fear of being unmasked in front of his audience, which at that point was growing into a national audience, that caused him to drop everything and flee the U.S.
What about discrediting him posthumously? Is there any move afoot to let the whole internet world know that this guy was, in fact, hypocritical in his behavior?
I think part of the problem is the United States government is probably the least credible possible spokesman on religion with the sort of target audience. The Muslim commentators who have discussed this possibility have suggested other kinds of things, you know, an Al Jazeera documentary about the real Anwar Awlaki, or a Muslim think tank putting out a white paper on who this guy really was. But, you know, it's tough to see how that would play out at a time in which ISIS, the Islamic State, is using cockamamie theology to justify rape and sex slavery. Would his prostitution habit actually have an impact on his popularity, or would his fans rationalize it as propaganda, as a sort of attempt to smear their hero?
There have been calls on YouTube to take down not just the explicit calls to violent jihad, but everything from this vast trove of Awlaki sermons, to diminish him as some sort of global spokesman. But it's a game of whack-a-mole. If you get rid of it on YouTube, it inevitably shows up elsewhere, no?
Exactly. I mean, YouTube, after a number of years, took down Awlaki's most inflammatory single video, something called A Call to Jihad, that he recorded in 2010. And they took it down earlier this year. The other day, I just put Awlaki Call to Jihad into Google, and it took me, you know, 0.003 seconds to find it on another site called Daily Motion. And I'm sure if Daily Motion takes it down, I'll be able to find it somewhere else. And particularly if his fans get the idea that there are folks trying to take Awlaki's material off the internet, I'm sure they'll be only too happy to put it back up. So it is a difficult proposition in a technical sense, let alone the sort of more philosophical question of whether this is what we want to do.
There is this problem of trying to fight a ghost. What, if anything, is the government doing about that, like, now?
Well, the government cannot, under the First Amendment, go around sort of trying to censor speech of this kind. Perhaps a better approach would be to try to attach it to counter-messaging. What if every time you searched for Awlaki on YouTube, you came up not only with his material, his own sermons and lectures, but you came up with news stories about his prostitution habit? Justice Brandeis once said that the way to combat bad speech is more speech, and I guess that's the way I'm inclined to think as a journalist.
Scott, thank you very much.
Bob, thanks for having me on.
Scott Shane is a reporter for the New York Times and author of Objective Troy, A Terrorist, A President, and the Rise of the Drone. Coming up, what if they held history's largest prison protest and nobody came? This is On the Media.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. On September 9th, the 45th anniversary of New York State's deadly Attica uprising, inmates at prisons across the country undertook what's been called the biggest prison protest in U.S. history. The grievances are familiar: overcrowding, brutality, poor health care, and poor sanitation. But the unifying theme was forced labor, often unpaid and unmonitored by the world outside. The protesters call that slavery, which is not necessarily hyperbole. In the 13th Amendment, otherwise abolishing slavery, there is an explicit exception for incarcerated criminals. Back in 1971, when 1,000-some Attica inmates seized control of the prison for 4 days and 43 people died in the ensuing state police operation, the issue of prison conditions was at the top of the news.
We want to apply the New York State minimum wage law to all state institutions. We want to stop to slave labor here. We want to allow all New York State prisoners to be politically active without intimidation or reprisal.
On this anniversary, the strike isn't exactly dominating the news. Azura Crispino is the media co-chair for the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, or IWOC, one of the activist groups behind the work strike. While she concedes the coverage of the anniversary protest pales next to 1971, the issues are, she says, back on the table.
The demands are very similar to the demands that were being made by the prisoners in Attica 45 years ago when they took over their unit.
Which is discouraging in the first instance, the same beef, lo these 45 years later. But I want to focus on the slavery issue. It seems to be the unifying theme, and it puzzles me because under the 13th Amendment, forced labor is deemed part of the punishment, part of rehabilitation, part of the means to defray the high cost of incarceration. What is the justification for trying to change that if it's more or less entirely the point of locking people up for their crimes?
Our position is that instead of locking people up for their crimes, we should really be focused on rehabilitation. So certainly work can be rehabilitative, but the type of work that prisoners are doing is not. It's exploitative.
Because they're prisons with very limited means of intercommunication. How in the world did they communicate among themselves to coordinate this thing?
There was a lot of work being done on the ground from a lot of different organizations that were reaching across the razor wire to help prisoners organize. But inmates are organizing themselves within their units. So it's more that the outside supporters are sending in a seed to the units, and then that seed is reverberating with the prisoners themselves.
As anyone who has an incarcerated family member or a friend knows, it is really hard to communicate with prisoners. Phone calls are monitored, letters are slow, visits are difficult to arrange. Were you able to defeat all of the obstacles that were arrayed before you?
Yes and no. In Texas, for example, we faced a lot of censorship from the mailroom, and the Texas Department of Criminal Justice is denying that any strike action occurred. But we had an activist who went and physically visited the unit, and when they were on the ground and talking to prisoners and talking to family members, the story that they heard was very different. So visits can be a lifeline. But for the most part, it really has been pen and paper letters, and then in very few cases, smuggled cell phones.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that. I am an expert on the American criminal justice system because I saw The Night Of, you know, every episode. I'm aware that there is such a thing as contraband cell phones that find their way into prisoners' hands. How useful were they in organizing these protests?
They've been useful in terms of being able to release video. So, for example, in South Carolina, we were able to get video of maggots in the food after the strike action began.
These are the bugs that was found in the cornmeal for the last few weeks. As you can see, the bugs crawling around in the cornmeal. South Carolina prison, this is what they're feeding us.
It has also allowed for a few prisoners to be able to more easily give interviews themselves.
I like to just be identified as I am one of the prisoners that is actually partaking in the national strike that was called on September the 9th in the Carolina.
It's certainly not the case that every person who's striking has a cell phone in their cell.
Look, I don't want to rub your nose in this, but I'm pretty much up to date on the Brangelina divorce. But the news of these protests all but eluded me. It just did not get much national coverage. Was it a success? Was it a failure? Was it something in between?
Well, certainly it's making a noise on the outside. 60 cities and 6 countries had protests on September 9th. It is the case that we have not seen as much media coverage as we would like, but I am getting a lot of emails and phone calls from journalists who are telling me, I'm not seeing this on the mainstream media, but it's all over my Facebook and my Twitter feed, which means that we are reaching the people on the ground who are ultimately the hearts and minds that we need to change. And that really is a credit to our brothers and sisters on the inside who are continuing to strike, even though they are facing horrible retaliation for continuing to do so.
It breaks my heart to ask this question, but the Attica protest, as you mentioned, 45 years ago, was meant to call attention to very similar prison conditions. But had it not resulted in violence and death, it most likely never would have made the headlines 45 years ago, much less history, much less the public consciousness. Did this strike require rioting and lethal force from authorities to escape the prison walls? Was it a flop because it was free of body bags?
Well, certainly I disagree that it was a flop. But in Florida, where there was more rioting, we had immediate television coverage. Whereas in places like Ohio or Wisconsin or California, where you have extreme hunger strike conditions going on, we're not seeing as much coverage. So I would ask the mainstream media, to what extent are you complicit in future violence if it were to arise, if the message that you are sending to prisoners is, if nobody dies, we're not going to cover it?
Irrespective of how many headlines you got on September 9th, you mentioned you built out an infrastructure to carry on your activities. What's the next move?
Right now, we're continuing to support the strikes that are ongoing. I realize that September 9th, from our perspective, was a long time ago. But prison time is different than time outside of the razor wire. We're receiving reports from inside of prisons where people are telling us, we had no idea that there was a strike happening on September 9th. When is the next one? We want to join in. I'm already hearing people say, this is what I'm planning on doing on September 9th next year.
Azura, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Azura Crispino is the media co-chair for the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, one of the activist groups behind the Attica anniversary strike. While technology has somewhat changed the dynamics of protest, the analog route to learning about prison life continues to be a challenge. Restrictive access and interview policies often bar journalists from simply communicating with inmates. Paul Wright has faced the challenge of reporting on prisons for decades. First as an inmate, he served 17 years for murder, and now as a free man. In 1990, while incarcerated, he launched Prison Legal News, a newsletter about criminal justice issues that has grown to be a monthly magazine for readers on both sides of the razor wire.
Even though we've had advances in technology that allow for even greater dissemination of information, we've also seen a concurrent crackdown by prison and jail officials limiting the ability of the outside media and the public to do that. Prisoners are generally not legally allowed to have access to the internet. They're not allowed to have access to means of mass communication. We've also seen a huge clampdown by prison systems forbidding access to journalists. For example, here in California, for I think we're going on 2 decades now, the state prison system has banned any individual interviews by media with individual prisoners. And that's the same across the country, as many, many states do not allow journalists to interview prisoners. They don't allow them to have access to the facilities. So it's not just a factor of the prisoners that are hamstrung. It's also the media that's very much hamstrung by these levels of censorship.
Understood. However, you can see how it's in the state's interest not to be able to have, for example, drug offenders, who represent a pretty large percentage of the prison population, able to continue their nefarious activities virtually from inside prison. So is the trade-off worth it?
This is the problem with blanket policies and blanket prohibitions, and this is also what ensures that prisons remain very non-transparent and non-accountable institutions. Nothing illustrates the failure of the so-called war on drugs than the fact that drugs are readily available in all of our maximum security prisons in this country, and this preceded the internet. So I don't think there's necessarily a connection between internet access and people engaging in criminal activities.
Well, let's talk about transparency for a moment, because the whole notion of incarceration creates some Bill of Rights anomalies. When you are a convicted felon, you surrender a good number of your citizens' rights. While it's not the NSA, it's probably in as dark an area from public scrutiny of any governmental institution.
I would actually say that there's more reporters dedicated to covering the NSA than there are to reporting on criminal justice issues in the community.
Because these are public entities, the press has access to certain public records, but is there any compelling constitutional reason that reporters should have access to prisoners whose liberty has been legally taken from them?
Sadly, the U.S. Supreme Court says no, but Paul Wright, the journalist, says yes. If you look at the statistical profile of the average American prisoner, it's someone who's mentally ill, functionally illiterate, and chances are they have a substance abuse problem as well. It's a very vulnerable population. They're a uniquely vulnerable population. Since the early 1980s, this country spent over $1 trillion, that's trillion with a T, on building new prisons and jails. It's our biggest public infrastructure construction project in modern American history. And yet these are the facilities that paid for 100% by taxpayers, yet the representatives of the taxpayers, the media, is generally not even allowed physical access to these facilities that we've sunk all this money into. And there's very little questioning about why this is or why this should be, which I think is even worse.
So your proposal is, with respect to coverage of prisons and the ability of prisoners to speak to the outside world, what?
Journalists should be allowed to have in-person visits and interviews. One of the big things that we face is not allowing prisoners to have access to the internet and or email. And I think we need to distinguish, too, there's the communication I think that prisoners may want to have, whether it's with the media or attorneys or human rights groups, versus the more mundane reality of being able to have contact and communication with their family. That's kind of a huge thing that often gets left behind in these discussions.
Well, I must ask, we only found out about the Attica anniversary protest kind of by accident. It made very, very little impact in the media sphere. Was it a flop?
I think there's a lot of things that happen where at the time we don't realize the significance of it. For any type of rights type struggle, first you have to have someone saying, we're entitled to this. You need the first woman that says, women need to be able to vote. And then that it might take 30, 40, 50 years for that to actually happen. You don't say, well, the first protest was a flop because they didn't get what they wanted.
Paul, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on the show.
Paul Wright is the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and editor of Prison Legal News. Freelance journalists and researchers, there's a great new fellowship opportunity for you. Big bucks to ply your trade. The only criterion is that you vow to focus your attention on the dealings of a single man, Peter Thiel. You know Peter Thiel as the co-founder of PayPal and as an early investor in Facebook. He is rich. You may also know him as the guy behind the seasteading movement and the funder of scientific research on how to live forever. Or you may know him as the man who brought down Gawker Media.
Behind the high-profile court case of Hulk Hogan versus the gossip website Gawker was a secret. Hogan, whose real name is Terry Bollea, got nearly $10 million to pay for his legal team from Silicon Valley billionaire Peter Thiel.
That lawsuit came with a $140 million judgment that sent Gawker Media spiraling into bankruptcy. Underwriting that suit, Peter Thiel, who said it was payback for outing him as gay in an article published in 2007, and was, he proclaimed, quote, one of my greater philanthropic things I've ever done. Michael Morrissey is co-founder of Muckrock, the organization behind the Thiel Fellowship. Michael, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you so much for having me.
Michael, what's Muckrock?
Muckrock is a tool that works with a variety of journalists, media organizations, and also independent people to make filing Freedom of Information Act requests and public records requests easier.
All right, so I want to read a passage to you from your request for Thiel Fellowship applications. It reads as follows, quote, prospective fellows could also help bring greater appreciation, attention, and understanding to a number of other fields that Thiel has shown interest in, from life extension to the creation of new nations at sea. Aw, that sounds like it's rooted in genuine respect, if not actual awe.
Well, I think Peter Thiel has shown that he is willing to use the legal system in any way that suits his ends. And we want to make sure that we use public records, which are a very protected form of reporting, and satire, which is another very protected form of media, to respond very carefully.
Satire? Oh, my stars. You mean this fulsome language is being playful?
Well, the article, the announcement, we had a little fun with that, but we think the issue is incredibly serious. We think that when multi-billionaires are able to take sort of well-established media organizations and drive them secretly out of existence, that's a really concerning precedent. It's concerning for individual journalists. It's concerning for major media organizations. And it means that a lot of reporters, a lot of editors are now thinking twice about the subjects they pursue. They're having to spend more on lawyers to vet stories before they come out. And that's a really concerning precedent.
Your concern is that billionaires with endless resources can secure gigantic judgments, not only that put an organization like Gawker out of business, but which will give other news organizations pause when they start digging into other people's dirt.
Absolutely. And a chilling effect even on individual journalists, because that's one of the things that Peter Thiel did, is he named individual editors, individual writers, and held them personally liable, which traditionally we haven't seen.
And what exactly do you hope to get from those who become the Thiel Fellows?
What we want to do with this fellowship is give resources to reporters who can help explain what some of these large and powerful and, quite frankly, very secretive companies that Peter Thiel has helped fund and helped create, help the public understand what's going on with them.
One in particular is on your radar. It's a company called Palantir.
It's a private company that's reportedly valued at $20 billion. And a lot of its revenue is coming from no-bid contracts with government agencies. And this company says that it can do what nobody else can do and that cities need its technology to keep their people safe. But we have almost no idea what taxpayers are actually paying for when their cities, when their states, when the federal government signs up with Palantir.
Now, I've got to ask you this, even though I suppose you could ask this of any investigative reporter undertaking any investigation of anyone, anywhere, ever. But sometimes there's smoke and no fire. If at the end of the research your Thiel Fellows have found nothing unsavory, if there are no shenanigans afoot, no abuse of money or influence, everything's all above board. In fact, he's a visionary and genius. Will Muckrock publish the good news?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Muckrock has been completely transparent with almost everything we do. We actually publish the request that our staff files, no matter how they turn out. And we plan to be completely transparent with this project as well. And I certainly hope we don't find anything. It would be wonderful news if Peter Thiel and all of his associations are perfectly clean and above board and that there's no waste, fraud, or abuse going on. That's my hope and dream. But I think, you know, when you have a $20 billion company, there's a lot that can go wrong. It doesn't mean that the people involved are all evil, but almost invariably in very large operations, very large mistakes are made.
So what are we talking about here? Bringing to bear the very kind of journalistic resources against Thiel that he suppressed in the Gawker case?
I don't think this is payback. This is not revenge. This is not saying Peter Thiel's an evil man out to destroy the world or use the blood of the young to live forever, as some people have written. This is an influential person. This is a public figure who is building these companies that takes taxpayer money, and they deserve scrutiny. But because of this previous legal case, there is more fear about covering this company, more fear about covering this individual. And we want to do what we can to counteract that, not as payback, but just because we think that's what good journalism is.
No attempts at prior restraint, no injunction requests by Peter Thiel, no efforts underway, as far as you know, to chill investigations before the fact?
We haven't received any yet.
Have you had 9,000, 10,000 applicants? None? Give me a range.
The applications are open through the end of the month, and we're going to be looking at them on a rolling basis after that. I think we've had 7 or 8 applications so far.
Was any of those applicants Nick Denton?
No, but I'll be keeping my eye out for him.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
Michael Morrissey is the co-founder of Muck Rock.
Where will the 1% go to rebuild our society? Luckily, Silicon Valley billionaire Peter Thiel has the answer, funding the creation of a network of artificial libertarian islands. Finally, a haven as connected to land as libertarians are to reality.
The first Clinton-Trump debate happens this week, and the pundits will be a-punditing. But we've got you covered with On the Media's patent-pending post-debate blather bingo board. You can find it at onthemedia.org/bingo. Print it out or play it online. Join us after the debate to watch some spin room blather and use hashtag blatherbingo on Twitter to tell us how you're doing. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, Paige Cowett, Michael Lowinger, and Sara Kari. We had more help from Leia Feder and Noah Kernis, and our show was edited this week by our executive producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Holford. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Overbrook Foundation and the listeners of WNYC Radio.